David Crow. Thank you for tuning into episode 154 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to make a monthly donation to this show, please go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth. And now let's go to this week's interview with Dr. Henry Bauer. Henry Bauer is back again with a new book, Science is Not What You Think, published by Macfarlane and available at all major booksellers. Dr. Bauer was Dean of Arts and Sciences at Virginia Tech, and during his teaching and research career was a PhD chemist. Previous books include Dogmatism in Science and Medicine, How Dominant Theories Monopolize Research and Stifle the Search for Truth, and The Origin, Persistence, and Failings of HIV/AIDS Theory. I should disclose that Henry Bauer is a board member of Rethinking AIDS, an organization of which I am the president. Both of us are unpaid for our positions in this organization. Welcome to the show, Henry.
Nice to be talking with you, David.
So, how would you describe the general population's view of science, at least in Western countries? The mythical man in the street. What do you think the average person thinks about science?
I think just about everyone believes that science is done by a scientific method, which involves not accepting a theory until the evidence has definitely shown that that theory is in keeping with the evidence. At the same time, science is often described as self-correcting. The same idea that it goes by the evidence, but it also contradicts the notion that the scientific method means that a theory isn't accepted until unless it satisfies the evidence. If it does that, then why does it ever need self-correction?
When I was a science student, my professor, who was guiding my thesis, said something about the scientific method, and I sort of had this horrible feeling. I don't really know what the scientific method is. It's like I kind of have an idea, but I've never actually seen a definition. So I went to try to find a definition of the scientific method, and it was difficult. Most places talked about it but didn't define it, and when they defined it, it was just in such vague terms I couldn't find it really, you know, any meaning in the definition. It was so broad. What would you say the scientific method is? Is it definable?
Well, the way science works is not definable in any simple way. I first heard about the scientific method when I was a postdoc in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I had a PhD in chemistry.
Right.
And I had never heard of the scientific method. And in Ann Arbor, Michigan, I was in an international house where the house parent was a sociologist. And one lunchtime, he was holding forth about the scientific method. And since then, of course, I've realized it is the social scientists who talk about the scientific method, and they teach their version of the scientific method. And my interpretation of that is social science wants to demonstrate that it is as scientific as chemistry, physics, biology, and so on. But chemistry, physics, and so on have their prestige because of the discoveries they've made.
Right.
And the social sciences do not have discoveries of that sort on which to base their claims. So they have to base their claims on doing the same sort of thing as the natural sciences.
That's really interesting. You also made an interesting comment. You said that history, which is a social science, that historians generally don't have a lot of truck with the scientific method. They focus on careful analysis of the published literature. Records. I mean, if you're studying, say, the Holocaust, you would want to get the records of the man who ran the concentration camp, and if there was a diary written by secretly by one of the prisoners, you would want to read that diary. You'd want to get literary written sources or recorded sources to then draw some conclusions. But it's hard to see how anything like the scientific method, experimentation, statistics could really help you, say, understand what happened in prison camps in Germany or Russia or somewhere like that, if you wanted to
Right,
capture the history.
and I think most historians actually disclaim any disclaim being called a social science even, and there's also a prejudice in history against drawing too general conclusions and too definitive conclusions. One of the things that I realized as I was writing this book, another thing that is always said about science is that to be scientific, an observation has to be reproducible. It occurred to me that observations cannot be reproducible if the phenomenon that is being observed is not reproducible. If you accept that, it means that you can't do science about living things, because what living things do is not reproducible.
Well, I guess some aspects are. I mean, you can plant a seed and you can produce the same plant, and then you can take seeds from the plant and plant it again and produce the same seed. So that's kind of reproducible. It's obviously not exactly the same organism, but it's got the
Well,
same number of petals and the same color and all this kind of stuff.
right.
But other things would not be in that characteristic. Like evolution, for example, evolution is if evolution has changed species to what they are now. You can't go back to, say, take a species back a million years and let's see what happens if we run the experiment again.
Right. It's already making an assumption, though, that any two seeds are identical, because one of the things that we've realized, and evolution depends on this, is that there's variation in the genomes.
Right, and also the environment. Like if somebody grows seeds and gives them to me, I might plant them and they don't grow, and I could say, well, the man was a fraud, these aren't seeds. Or he would say, you just don't know how to grow them. Or maybe when I
Right.
grow them they look different, and he would say, well, you didn't use the right fertilizer or something, right? So
Right. At any rate, I think that the sort of knowledge that we can get about the behavior of living things is of a sort of statistical nature, which is different from what you have in physics and chemistry. The beauty of the advantage of physics is that elementary particles are all identical to one another. So you can study sets of those objects and draw conclusions about what the individual objects are doing.
Right.
A great problem, to my mind, in medicine, modern medicine, is that statistical information is applied to individuals. We try to
Yes.
get everybody's blood pressure to the same level. which makes no sense, because if you do any sort of study of a group of people, the blood pressure of healthy people varies all over the place.
Right, and so on that basis, you could say that everybody has an ideal blood pressure, but we don't know what that is.
Right.
So we're going to just say that there's an average blood pressure, and we'll keep reducing it till you hit it, and then we'll say, okay, you must be healthier now.
Right.
Even if not. I mean, one of the other problems with medicine and with psychology and other things like that is that humans are sentient beings. So if humans know that they're being experimented upon, they change their behavior accordingly. If they think, for example, that they're taking a shiny new pill that's going to cure some disease, they're likely to report that they're feeling better just because they've been given the pill, which is why you have to use a placebo. But that's not without its flaws.
Right. But, you know, the underlying purpose of the book is sort of along these lines. I've wondered at various times, I'm sure many people have, why is it that the definitive evidence that Rethinking AIDS and others puts forward, showing that HIV is not the cause of AIDS, why has that not been generally accepted?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one side of that answer is that as far as the media and the general public are concerned, when an official statement is made about something scientific, it's accepted without further ado. When a good friend of mine in Australia first read my HIV/AIDS book, he found the argument, the data, convincing. He said, the trouble is that after people read this, they may lose confidence in science in general. And I think that what is needed is for a general understanding of how science actually works, so that a scientific consensus is not automatically accepted without further ado as being the truth, irrespective of what a minority of perfectly competent experts says.
It's interesting that consensus, scientific consensus, is used by people who are often non-scientists to say, you know, why do 97% of climate scientists believe in climate change? As if that was in any way meaningful. I mean, every new radical new scientific change, not everyone perhaps, but a lot of radical new scientific changes start with a single person who has a unique idea. So
right.
by that measure, we should reject all scientific change because it's owned by one person that point.
And the history of science is the story of scientific consensuses being continually modified or overturned and changed.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is new, in my emphasis at least, is the degree to which scientific activity changed dramatically, out of sight, around the time of the Second World War.
Right.
I think up to that time, the sort of idealistic view of science as being done by disinterested people who were just interested in finding out how the world actually works, that was not so different from reality.
Mm-hmm.
But following World War II, science had become so involved in just about everything in society that they're not disinterested people doing science anymore. There's been such an explosion of scientific activity that it's become too big for its own good, and the competition for careers and for grants has become absolutely cutthroat.
Well, if we go back to like around the Second World War or a little bit before, I mean, science demonstrated its power. I guess the biggest demonstration of scientific power was the nuclear bomb.
Right.
You could not, I mean, I don't think there were too many people prior to that who could really believe that the scientific that the physics was correct on that. It just didn't make sense that this small quantity of material could produce an explosion that could destroy a city. That just didn't seem possible. But when it actually happened, people had a visual indication.
I remember I was in high school still when the atom bomb was dropped. And I remember that I was going home on a streetcar and I saw this poster. I saw a poster for newspapers saying atom bomb exploded. And I remember sneering mentally because I knew that was impossible for atoms to do that. You know, I was a chemistry student, still in high school, of course, but you know, I just didn't believe that anything to do with atoms would have anything to do with bombs. So you're right that you know, this was a staggering change in public understanding or view of what science can do.
And also, I mean, during World War II, there was the development of radar, and again, you know, the ability of this small electronic device to be able to see airplanes in the darkness in a thick rain. So many of the advances, many of them used to kill people, but still, they demonstrated the power of science. Physics and chemistry, I guess, were demonstrated quite vigorously during World War II, which I guess developed a lot of confidence that if scientists say they can do something, they can do it.
It's generally agreed that a report that Vannevar Bush wrote to the president just after the Second World War was very influential, pointing out that the marvels that science had done in service during the war, imagine what could be done if science was equally put to the service of the general good of people as a whole.
We could cure
And
cancer. I mean,
yes,
that's not
so
funny, but that's the logical outcome. If we put the effort that we put into the Manhattan Project, we declare, you know, war on the Germans and the Japanese, and we win. Now let's declare war on cancer, on heart disease, and
and
we've lost every one of those wars.
exactly. Anyway, that was when the National Science Foundation was founded, and National Institutes of Health got a
Right.
tremendous increase in budget. So, you know, the belief that science can do anything we want is still with us.
I mean, there's a lot of reasons for the failures. One of them is because we've increasingly moved towards biology, and you know, a cancer is not an atom. Cancer is not a single thing. It is many different things. And also, if a cancer is a response to perhaps like toxic chemicals in the body or radiation or things like that, if you don't deal with the cause, you're not necessarily going to stop the cancers from forming. But another problem with science that you bring up is fraud and misconduct, things like that. You know, the image of science is that scientists are disinterested parties, they're all honest, but that's not really the reality. What would you say about fraud and misconduct?
Well, that is one of the indications of just how drastically science has changed because the number of scientists has grown so much that the competition is absolutely cutthroat. Traditionally, science was regarded as a very honest sort of, that people in doing science were exceptionally honest and straightforward and disinterested. And in 1980, a couple of science journalists, Broad and Wade, published a book called Fraud and Deceit in the Halls of Science. And they maintained that deception, dishonesty, had been part of science from the very beginning. That book was not treated very kindly by the scientific community, and I wrote a very scathing review of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that they had seen something about contemporary science and the amount of dishonesty that had crept into it. So they saw what many, many people in science didn't yet recognize, that the intense cutthroat competition was making more and more people fudge, cut corners, and do even blatantly dishonest things like making up data, cherry-picking data, of course. And maybe 10 years later, things had got to the stage that the federal government set up an Office of Research Integrity.
Right.
Now, you know, that term 50 years earlier would have been unthinkable.
Right.
But nowadays, universities in the United States that get grants through the federal government must have available courses on research ethics, so that the people who get grants can be taught how to behave properly.
Well, I'm sure accountants get courses in, you know, maybe in ethics or something like that. I think most accountants realize that you're not supposed to cook the books. But if there's enough money in it, some people will do it.
Right.
Or if they're put under pressure. I mean, I worked for a company that was cooking the books, and I wasn't in the accounting department. I knew some people there, and they said they were scared to death because what they'd participated in was fraudulent, but they'd been told to do it by higher-ups because somebody was going to make the books look good, even if they had to lie about it. And well, so I'm sure scientists are the same. You can talk to them until you're blue in the face. But if somebody thinks they're going to lose their degree unless they fake the data, or if somebody wants to make a name for themselves and needs to fake the data to make their data look dramatic, they're going to do it no matter what.
Exactly. And I mean, one lesson I hope of the book is that scientists are just like other people.
Mm-hmm.
The stereotypes of scientists, of course, picture them as not like other people.
Well, it's like if you look at a program like Law and Order, what I noticed is whenever there's a psychologist on the program, they have this incredible ability to take a little bit of information about a suspect and from it, like, draw this exact picture of what this person's going to do and pretty much tell you where they're going to go and what they're going to do when they get there.
Yeah.
Of course, that's completely fraudulent, but that is what people think, that scientists have this incredible ability to predict the future, and their predictions are always based on data and not based on what they might want you to believe.
Right. So we're ready to believe that computer models can tell us what the Earth's climate is going to be 100 years from now.
Well, interestingly, in Hurricane Harvey, I was reading an article, the U.S. Weather Service has a new model that completely mispredicted the hurricane. The Europeans had a different model, which was actually quite accurate. But even that is only accurate, I think it was off by 160 kilometers, which is considered
quite accurate, but of course, if you're in a hurricane, 160 kilometers is a huge difference. And even within that error, I mean, it could mean that a hurricane would go smack through Houston, or it would go around it, and the damage could be minimal. And that's predicting something that's a few days away, not a century away.
Yeah, there's a favorite quote of mine that from Michael Crichton about Michael Crichton was a well-known science fiction writer, but he was also an MD originally, and he really understood science. And he gave a talk called Aliens Cause Global Warming, in which he made the point, which I think everybody should be clear about. He said, consensus is only invoked when the science is not solid enough. He said, no one says the consensus is that E equals MC squared, or the sun is 93 million miles away from Earth. He says no one would dream of talking like that.
Right.
We talk about consensus only when we want to shut the opponents up, but we can't do it by means of the evidence and the facts.
A couple of things about the consensus on climate change, which is always 97%. There's apparently three or four papers that have all come to the same conclusion that climate scientists are all 97% agreement that the climate is warming due to human actions. I find it remarkable that they all come up to the same number. But I looked into one of those papers, and they had basically found it was actually a much smaller percentage, but then they redefined, what did they call it? They redefined significant climate scientists as people who had published a certain number of papers. And so, of course, in an environment where the dominant theory is that humans are causing climate change, you're much more likely to be able to publish if you believe that. Therefore, by insisting that only recently published scientists would be included, they could go from about 60% to 97%. And then there were some big surveys that showed much lower numbers, and those were just ignored. And they had methodological quarrels with those surveys, so they could ignore them. But it seemed to me that they were just picking numbers until they got to something that was close to 100%. They couldn't say 100% because everybody knows there's a few scientists who don't agree. But 97 sounds pretty good.
Yeah, well, and you could do the same thing with HIV/AIDS.
I'm sure you could get 97%. Yes.
Well, I mean, try to publish anti-HIV articles in the mainstream. We have the experience of trying to do that even in what was founded as an independent journal, Medical Hypotheses.
Right.
And, all hell broke loose.
Yeah, I mean, they ended up firing the editor, and they ended up completely changing the purpose of the journal. So Medical Hypothesis is now a completely irrelevant journal because everything's peer-reviewed, which was designed not to be peer-reviewed, so it would give an outlet to science that couldn't get through peer review. And probably most of what got into Medical Hypothesis was wrong, but it doesn't matter if a little bit gets into Medical Hypothesis that's right, because it couldn't get into other journals because it's just too far out, that would make it worth it.
Right. The Thomas Gold was an astrophysicist who was renowned for coming up with absolutely crazy ideas all the time. And one or two or three of those turned out to be absolutely brilliant and left their mark on the field forevermore.
Yes. Well, like I say, how could you, if somebody really has a completely different idea, how could it not be out there, and how could it not be an isolated idea at first? You quote a guy, Ioannidis, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Ioannidis,
Ioannidis.
Ioannidis, yes. Yeah. Who says that most research results are false. Is this just in medicine or in general?
I think it was in biological matters that he did the statistics, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I think the article was published in the American Medical Association Journal, so it may have drawn on that largely. But Ioannidis is continually doing studies of failure to replicate and so on.
Yeah, because, I mean, one of the things about science is it's supposed to be replicated, but the publication process introduces some interesting, how would I say?
There's a bias against.
Right, and interesting biases, like you said, a bias against replication because it's not exciting to replicate a result that's already been found. Where are you going to get that published?
Right. Originality is supposed to be an important criterion in getting things published. And what that means is that people don't try to exactly repeat things, except in really exceptional cases. But there's a lack of real testing of what are claims. The way claims really get tested in practice in science is they get accepted and people try to build on them. And if the building doesn't quite work, then they try some other things and eventually perhaps realize that what they were trying to build on wasn't really sound.
And I mean, that sounds pretty clinical, but what that can mean is that scientists research a drug, they produce data that seems to indicate that the drug works, it gets submitted to the government, the drug gets approved, and then we find out that people are dying of something unexpected. And then we withdraw the drug, and then we say, this drug actually causes heart attacks, or it causes worsening of diabetes, or something like that.
Well, the pharmaceutical industry is actually a terrible example of things going wrong more or less all the time. The rate at which newly approved drugs have to be withdrawn mm-hmm. has become... the interval has become shorter and shorter. And you can see advertisements on television for drugs at the same time as you see advertisements by law firms who are having class action suits against those very drugs because of the damage they're doing.
In David Healy's book, Let Them Eat Prozac, which is about the dangers of antidepressants, he was an expert witness in a lot of lawsuits. And in one of these cases, he was in the bar and he saw somebody he knew who was working for the other side, working for the drug company. Maybe it was after the case was over, so they were allowed to talk. And he said, why did you fight this so hard when you knew you were going to lose? And he said, you know, our annual sales are $1 billion a year. So if we can drag this out another year, we can make another $1 billion. And if they pay $100 million in compensation, it's much better to pay $100 million a year later when you've made another billion. Then it's just a little 10% error on your accounting.
Right. And there are data about hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of dollars that drug companies have paid in fines because they have advertised some of their drugs illegally. Mm-hmm. You know, doctors are allowed to prescribe any drug for anything even if it hasn't been officially approved. That's so-called off-label prescribing.
Right.
But the drug companies are not allowed to advertise off-label uses. But they find ways to do it, and they keep paying fines when they're caught, because the fines they pay are trivial compared to the money they make from the sales.
I think most people just don't understand how big the money is from drugs. And, you know, if a drug company gets hit with a fine, it's a big enough fine that most companies will be pulled down and destroyed. But to a drug company, it's just the cost of doing business.
Yeah. I think one of the things that it's not strictly about science, but drug companies and such organizations are huge entities where I think various left hands don't know what the right hands are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And when from the top, the aim, the mission is always make more money, then all sorts of things that shouldn't happen do happen.
Yeah, so if you approve a drug for a relatively narrow condition, then, you know, maybe for a certain subgroup of people, then you want to expand that to all people. And maybe you want to expand the definition of the condition. And there's lots of examples of those. Like you have a drug for blood pressure, so you change the standard, which is considered your blood pressure is too high. Or you have a drug for AIDS, which you at first give for people who are sick, and then you gradually broaden it and broaden it till now to the point where they're giving AIDS drugs to people who are not even HIV positive to prevent them from becoming HIV positive. But it's all to broaden the sales of the drugs.
Yeah, and another technique is to invent diseases.
Mm-hmm.
There have been several books published about that, explaining in detail public relations campaigns that converted perfectly normal human conditions into diseases that have to be that can be treated medically.
With drugs with side effects that might kill you.
Right. You mentioned David Healy. He has also published a book called Pharmageddon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's quite the title.
Yeah, and a fellow called Peter Goetcher, who is in Denmark, and he's director of the Cochrane Center.
I've interviewed him, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, his book, I think, is called... what is it? He actually indicts the drug companies in the same way as he compares them to the tobacco companies.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's really actually remarkable to me how many mainstream trained scientists. I mean, you're an example. David Healy, Peter Gotchi, others that many of whom I've interviewed are so critical about the drug companies, the medical industry. I interviewed a guy who was very interested in the malaria drug mefloquine, and he's really concerned because the drug can cause psychotic behavior. And it can cause the symptoms, basically, of PTSD, which means when a soldier comes home with PTSD, you don't really know if it was the war that made it or that they were given mefloquine.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that the drug is given once a week and it makes the soldiers really edgy and really trigger happy. And then he said what just shocked me. He said, and I think that the U.S. military likes it that way. That they don't mind that on Mondays, you know, if they give the drug on Sundays, that on Mondays the soldiers are much more likely to pull the trigger than on Friday when the drug's more out of the system. Kind of shocked me, but that's kind of the level of ethics that we're sometimes dealing with.
Yeah.
You talked about statistics and science, and they're not the same thing, but they're highly correlated, if I can use that word. So, but you talked about the p-value, confidence intervals, things like that. So how do you think statistics is misused in science?
One of the most dangerous terms is statistical significance.
Mm-hmm.
I think that outsiders presented with that term, this has been proved with statistical significance, it's statistically significant, mm-hmm. assume that that is the same thing as proving cause and effect in physics, and it
right.
isn't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's all a matter of probabilities. And what's worse is that the typically used criterion of statistical significance is that the chance that something has happened for no reason at all is 5% or less.
Mm-hmm.
So then you've got a 95% level of confidence. What
right.
that means is that if you do 100 trials, in 5 of them, you will not get the result that you claim is statistically significant. If you do things 20 times, 1 out of those 20 times is likely to fail. Now, from a personal level,
mm-hmm.
1 in 20 chance of something going seriously wrong is much too risky as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let's play Russian roulette. I'll give you a gun with 20 slots and one bullet. Are you going to pull the trigger?
Exactly.
I doubt it.
Exactly.
But you also pointed out that 5% is not really 5%, because the 5%, for example, assumes that your sampling is perfectly random. It assumes that the actual real data for which you're sampling, so you don't actually know what the real population is, it assumes that it's normally distributed. There's a lot of assumption that goes into that 5%. So you said that in some cases it might be closer to 30%, not 5%.
Right. I cite an article by a statistician that goes into real detail about that.
Mm-hmm.
But something else about the p-value thing that people don't generally realize is that it's assumed that the hypothesis that you're interested in is being tested by applying this sort of statistics. But it isn't. What the statistics actually does is to estimate how unlikely it is that the result was obtained purely by chance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the statistical significance is that it was not obtained purely by chance, that doesn't tell you why it was obtained.
Right. So if you let's say you study watching television and weight, and you find that people who watch more television are more overweight than people who watch less television, that could mean that overweight people are more likely to watch television, or watching a lot of television makes you more overweight, right?
Exactly.
There could be.
Exactly.
A causes B or B causes A, or neither.
Of course, when that's reported in the media, they do it as though it shows that watching television makes you put on weight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, of course, that's kind of a simplistic example, but there are many cases where it's actually pretty difficult to say what came first. And I think you gave an example of recently with AIDS, where A came before B, but B was considered the cause of A. Do you remember that? There's been things like, for example, CD4 counts, which are seen as the decline of the immune system. They often decline before people become HIV positive. So one would say that the CD4 count causes the HIV positivity, but because that doesn't fit within the HIV model, they will turn around and say HIV causes a loss of CD4 cells, even though the loss started before you became HIV positive.
Right. Right. The confusion of correlation with causation is terribly common, and it's really damaging. And for that matter, even determining correlations is not as straightforward as one might think. I remember there was one occasion when some large correlation coefficient was being was given, and it made me think about it, and I asked my friend Jack Good about it, and he pointed out to me that the general the way most people interpret correlation is, if A is doubled, then B will double. A and B are correlated if that happens.
Right.
But statisticians know that that is linear correlation.
Right.
And if, for example, you use the Excel way of calculating a correlation coefficient,
right,
it doesn't calculate a linear correlation coefficient. All it does is to tell you whether B increases as A increases. But it may be that B increases exponentially,
right,
while A increases linearly. And Jack actually showed, had written an article in which he showed that you get a very high correlation coefficient, not only between X and Y, but between X and Y squared, X and Y cubed, X and Y to the fourth, and so on.
Which is that, I mean, that's kind of interesting, where Microsoft makes something really easy for you, but most people don't understand what it is. What they're getting is, you know, probably intended for, you know, economic modeling. You know, if we increase the minimum wage, does unemployment go up or down? Right? Is there a correlation?
Right.
But that's very different than a linear correlation. And even with linear correlation, of course, there's no, mathematicians aren't telling you that A causes B or B causes A, or even that there is a causal connection. I mean, maybe both of them are influenced by C and not really connected directly. We don't know that at all.
Yeah. One of the things I gained by being Dean of Arts and Sciences for a while was I learned quite a lot about various disciplines. Statistics, for example, is taught not just in statistics departments, but in psychology departments, in schools of education, and so on. And then the people who have learned those things think they can apply that in further work. And at my place, the statistics department was on a continual campaign to try to get people in other disciplines who were going to publish papers using statistics. They kept trying to get them to consult a professional statistician before they published.
Right.
There's a heck of a lot of simply incompetent statistics that is in the literature, especially in medical journals.
Well, when I recently published an article on the Ebola vaccine, the numbers that were published were, I guess the geeky term is borked. They were just trying to put out numbers that made things look good. And, you know, often there was no p-value reported, or you know, the logical data was not reported. There were just so many problems with how they presented the numbers, because they were trying to make an argument, not just dispassionately display numbers. And I think generally statisticians are more aware of the limitations of their own techniques, and don't like to be pushed into saying, well, have we proved A causes B? You'll never get a statistician to say that.
No, I mean, professional statisticians, by and large, know what they're doing.
Right.
But although something that I think, again, many people don't realize is that within statistics, there is no real overall agreement on the definition of probability. And yet the whole field is based on probability.
That surprises me.
Well, there are two views of probability. One of them, straightforward. You toss a coin 100 times and it comes up 95 times in a long enough series of 100 tosses. So the probability of a coin when it is unbiased coming up half the time, the probability is 0.5.
Mm-hmm.
But we also use the term probability for inherent things. And this first method based on frequency of things is called the frequentist view. And right. It's also sometimes called Fisherian. Mm-hmm. Ronald Fisher was the one who popularized or founded that. An alternative view that Jack Good was prominent in resuscitating is the Bayesian view, which is that there may be an inherent probability. And that's right. The sort of thing that is very important when it comes to human beings in particular. When O.J. Simpson was on trial, what is the probability that a husband who used to beat his wife is going to murder his ex-wife after they're divorced? Mm-hmm. And Jack pointed out that there are two separate things that you have to look at. One is, if a woman has been murdered who was divorced from a husband who used to beat her occasionally, what's the probability right. that the murderer was the husband? That's relatively high.
Right.
The other probability, what's the probability that a battering husband will later murder his divorced wife, is quite low.
Right, right. Which means we shouldn't get into pre-crime. we shouldn't be getting into throwing people in jail for what we think they might do in the future.
Right. But, I mean, that was an interesting situation because Alan Dershowitz is a very prominent lawyer mm-hmm. and is often interviewed and so on, didn't understand what Jack Good was pointing out on that.
Right, right. Well, it is, some of that stuff is pretty difficult to get your head around. We're running out of time in our interview. I can't believe almost an hour has gone by. So is there anything else you'd like to say about your book before we're finished?
Yeah, the book concludes with something about science court.
Mm-hmm.
A corollary, since you can't necessarily trust the scientific consensus at any time as being really true, what should we do about issues where important things are at issue and experts are disagreeing?
Right.
And 50 or 60 years ago, there was a proposal made that we need an independent institution of some sort in those cases. And that proposal was made at a time when there was argument about whether nuclear reactors could generate power safely.
Mm-hmm.
And an engineer proposed that we needed some independent body to somehow adjudicate, because there were experts on both sides, both perfectly sure they were right and citing evidence and estimates and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And since that time, the idea of a science court has been discussed several times. And I think that a very important benefit from a science court would be that it could actually force open discussion of the substantive issues. Because at the moment, rethinking AIDS, you know, is sort of whistling in the wind.
Right.
Because we can't get substantive engagement with the people who insist that HIV equals AIDS. And until you've got substantive open engagement, there's no way for observers, the media, or policymakers to really understand what the actual technical issues are that are being disputed.
Right. My concern reading that was that the establishment would end up setting up a court which is designed to fail. Like, I think about the medical sort of pseudo-tribunals. Like, they have a doctor in Australia has recently said that he has observed many cases of vaccine adverse reactions, and predictably he was set upon, and they're now in the process of trying to strip him of his license. So they're going to have a judicial tribunal-like process, and it's probably going to result in his license being taken from him, because in reality it's not an open process. It's a process designed to achieve the goal of the institution, which is right. To get rid of troublemakers.
Yeah, independence is the essential point there.
Yes.
And I mentioned that there are at least a couple of precedents for government setting up things that are actually independent, like the Congressional Budget Office,
right.
Which puts out figures that the government doesn't like at all.
Which is always a good sign that they're onto something.
Right.
Well, I would encourage people to get your book, Science Is Not What You Think. There's a lot of good material in there, and it will make you think. Thanks for joining me today, Henry.
Thanks very much, David. Having people thinking is a great ambition.
Yes.
If we had a thinking population, elections might turn out differently.
Yes. Lots of things would be better. Okay, yeah. Thanks, Henry. Goodbye.
Yeah, thanks, David.
Thank you for listening to episode 154 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for future guests, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.